It's the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is April the 13th, Thursday, and I would like to open a public hearing again on Senate Bill 5524. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We're going to have a short presentation by the HEC staff on the sort of the public services and statewide programs for the public universities, and then you'll notice on the agenda there are, I think, 14 speakers on the slide set. We're going to skip the capital budgeting today, so we have time for all these other folks. So we're going to be starting on slide 399, which is the one that is up on your on the screen right now. And remember that the public testimony for the public university services programs, public university support fund, and other things are on Monday. That does not include capital projects. That will be held in the capital construction subcommittee. That will be announced sometime in the next week on what day that will be. So public testimony on Monday should not include the various proposals for capital construction.
Thank you. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We will be very brief this morning in just introducing the topics and then ceding the majority of the time to the representatives of the universities, who will describe in greater detail the work that we will provide just a very general introduction to from a budget perspective.
Mr. Chair, Ben, this is slide 390, not correct. 399.
Mr. Chair, over the last 2 days of presentation, you've heard our focus on the public universities, but with a primary interest and focus on the Public University Support Fund, which, of course, is the largest source of state investment in the public universities. Today, we'll shift gears and focus on a couple of other budget items that are smaller but also very significant and important. The public services, or the state investments in public services and statewide programs. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Andrew.
Mr. Rogers, welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members. Yeah. For the record, Andrew Rogers, Director, University Budget and Finance at the HEC. As Ben mentioned, we have just a handful of slides to go through this morning before handing the presentation off to the public universities. This slide format should look familiar to you all. We are presenting here the current 2015-17 budget for the public university state programs and also the current service level budget and governor's budget. Included in public university state programs are several individual programs at the campuses. These are primarily at the three large institutions, Portland State University, Oregon State University, and the University of Oregon. This list is generally consistent with past state programs, with an inclusion of the PSU profiling study, the second from the bottom. That was funded in the current biennium, and the governor's budget has chosen to continue that program in the future. As I mentioned, these programs are primarily at the research institutions. They represent a range of missions, everything from mediation to demographic forecasting. Turning now to the statewide public service programs, you'll recognize these as the Extension Service, the Agricultural Research Program, and also the Forest Research Lab. Again, we have a slide showing the current legislatively adopted budget relative to CSL and the governor's budget. This slide demonstrates funding for the statewides over time. This is not an inflation-adjusted slide. What may be obvious is the reinvestment that was made in the 2015-17 biennium. That continues in the governor's budget. You'll notice a large increase in the Extension Service budget. This is due to Measure 99.
Do you have that slide?
Representative Wisnett?
I just don't have that slide. I'll get it from Doug. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The increase in the extension service budget that you notice is the result of Measure 99, which was approved by the voters in November, that allocated $44 million in lottery funds to the extension service to design and provide grant awards to schools for outdoor schools programs.
That'd be nice. Okay. All right.
Outdoor school, right?
Thanks, Doug.
Yep.
Correct. And that concludes the slides that we have prepared for you. Okay.
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Rogers, all the public service programs, I'm familiar with a lot of them, especially the Oregon Extension. I'm aware of the they're going to be back and testify, so we're going to hear a little bit about what they're doing and why we're supporting them.
Representative Wisnant, co-chairs, yes. Today, from the universities, you'll hear about many, if not all, of the programs that are included within this budget request.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? So the Oregon Climate Change Research, that was just changed. Was that changed, that institution, or has that been around? And the same thing for the, what's the Signature Research Center?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, the Oregon Climate Change Research Institution exists in the current biennium, so that
it's a new one.
I'm not sure if that is new in the current biennium. We will find that information.
Senator Roblin has the answer.
No, it's not new. They've had it for a while. Okay. They're just checking, and I think that one's maybe out of Portland State, but I got to figure out what number.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Wisnant.
I thought the governor's budget did not fund the Resolution Center. Is that correct or not? There's something, the mediation she didn't fund, but this is different. Wasn't that true? Didn't she?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnant, the governor's budget does include funding for the Dispute Resolution Center at Portland State University and the University of Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay. Who's next? Welcome, sign in, and here we go.
Should be able to just click forward.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Reynolds, for the record, and I am the Vice President of Finance Administration of Portland State University and also the Interim Vice President of Research at our university. And I'll be the MC today for the Public University budget presentation. Our goal today is to show you the value of the Oregon Public Universities and our missions that extend beyond the classroom and into the rural and urban communities in every county of the state. I'm going to start off by showing you just a short presentation about the funding buckets, and then I will move on to different presenters who will tell you about the individual programs. There are many more details in the packet that have been provided to you. In the interest of time, we've just selected a few to talk about today. So yesterday, we had an opportunity to talk to you about the Public University Support Fund. That is, of course, our main operational funds provided from the state. But today we want to talk to you about other funding allocations, specifically the sports lottery. And then we'll move into the public university state programs. There are 13 of those, and we will be highlighting two of those, including a request for additional funding for the Oregon Renewable Energy Center, OIT. And then we will move on at the end, time permitting, to talk about the statewide public services at Oregon State University. I want to be clear that all of these appropriations and benefits impact both students and have economic impacts across the state. So in terms of funding buckets, you can see the largest allocation is to the Public University Support Fund, and then a much significantly smaller but very important allocations that go to the sports lottery, public university state programs, and the statewide public service programs at Oregon State University. We'll be talking about those, but I wanted to make sure it's clear that all of those aren't standalone programs. They really are interwoven across all of our missions in terms of teaching, research, and public service. And all of them have an a focus on economic development. So without further ado, I want to move on to the first of those, which is sports lottery. And for that, to help explain the importance of those funds at our universities, I'd like to introduce Valerie Cleary, the athletic director at PSU, and two student athletes, Nakia Evans and Cedronio Rangel. Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. As Kevin said, I'm Valerie Cleary. I'm the Director of Athletics at Portland State University. I'm here to talk to you about sports lottery. Sports lottery has been around for 17 years, as many of you know, and it's one of the key ways that we are able to provide scholarship opportunities to student athletes, such as the ones that we have here with us today. The funding here provides us with opportunities to not only provide scholarships to student athletes, but provide them with an equitable opportunity at our college level to participate in college sports. On your information there, you see in 1989, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3262, giving Oregon Lottery the statutory authority to establish a sports betting program. That funding goes to our universities to help support our student athletes through scholarship.
I should switch to the next
Senator
page.
Roblin?
I was just going to say you should switch to the next page because that has the information on it.
Oops.
There it is.
There you go.
Thanks. I saw people looking.
So on there, you'll see on that slide that 88% of the funding goes to intercollegiate athletics. Specifically at Portland State, for example, we receive $1 million of that directly to our budgets in order to support our student athletes. And it's similar across the state for many of the institutions. 12% of that also goes to graduate students for academic scholarships, even outside of athletics. So for us, essentially, from our personal standpoint here at Portland State, you'll see that we have over 300 student athletes that benefit from this funding. Without this funding, it will drastically impact our ability to provide scholarships to our student athletes. We depend on that funding not only for the actual cash value of that, but because for us at the NCAA Division I level, we actually receive matching funds from the NCAA at a significant level based upon the number of scholarships we're able to provide. So if the number of scholarships that we're able to provide decreases due to the lack of the sports lottery funding, we will also receive a lesser impact from the NCAA, which would drastically impact our opportunities for our student athletes. You'll hear from these student athletes about their unique experience. I think they have the most valuable story to tell in all of this. One of the key things I also want to mention is with our student athletes, because of Title IX federal law with equity, if there is an impact to sports scholarships, we have to equally have that both be for a male and female student athlete. So we'll have a direct impact on providing our female student athletes with an opportunity for scholarships along with our male student athletes. I'm going to pass it over, though, to Nakia Evans, who's actually a local Salem resident, and have her tell you a little bit about her story.
Welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Warner, and members of the committee. My name is Nakia Evans, and I'm a senior at Portland State. I play soccer. I'm majoring in biology, minoring in chemistry. I'm part of the Honors College, and I'm completing my pre-med prerequisites. Actually, the last two nights I worked night shifts as a scribe, and so this was a particularly early morning for me. So athletics has always played a very large role in my life, shaping the decisions that I've made. I've always wanted to both focus on my academics as well as my athletics. Portland State gave me the opportunity to do so, play Division I soccer, and pursue a later career in medicine. I chose Portland State not only because of their athletic program, but also because they are great academically and because of the financial aid that I was provided. I had other offers, but I decided to stay in state because of that financial aid. It was a combination of athletic and academic aid. I graduated from South Salem High School here in 2013. A couple years ago, though, the academic aid was pulled. Portland State, and as you know, has had some budget cuts and stuff like that, but athletics was able to pick up a little bit of the academic aid that I lost, which largely contributed to myself being able to continue at Portland State and for my parents to be able to fund my brother's education also in state. I'm definitely not the only person from Salem or from Oregon that I know is going to a public school because of the athletic aid that is provided and partly funded by the sports lottery fund. Cutting the sports lottery fund would mean decreasing the number of opportunities for student athletes to participate in sports at our public universities. That would further decrease the amount of students and members of the schools that would be staying in state if not for this fund. So I strongly ask that you consider keeping it and really emphasizing its importance to not only student athletes but also to in-state residents.
Well, we're glad you're still in Oregon and look forward to your continued athletic career, and also someday you're going to be a very special doctor, I know.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, just a question on your scholarship. A lot of times, like, student athletes will maybe have to do some work in the gym or work somewhere, company to get as part of the thing with scholarship. Did you have to do some work on campus somewhere to get that, or was it just a straight help and dollars?
So I didn't do the work study. My brother does work study though at Pacific University.
Okay. Oh, great. Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Rangel.
All right. Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Smith Warner and members of the committee. See me.
You're more important than all.
I like this computer now.
Mr. Wilson's going to set it down so we can see you.
Thank you. Come right here. Okay. Sorry, sir. Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Smith Warner and members of the committee. My name is Cidron Yarangel, ASCOU Student Body President for Eastern Oregon University. I thank you for allowing me some time to share my story with every single one of you this morning. So I'll go ahead and start. My dad used to tell me stories of why he and my mom worked the way they did. Stories about their decision to move to the United States and their constant struggle to provide resources for my upbringing and education. Those stories taught me to value higher learning and never take it for granted. When my parents left Guanajuato, Mexico, they knew exactly what they wanted for their family, an education that they never received. That is why I'm here today. Without the multitude of opportunities that higher education has offered me, I wouldn't be here today. I would still be feeding cattle at 4 a.m. in the morning, every single day, cleaning irrigation ditches, fixing barbed wire fences, and working 2 to 3 jobs on campus just to make ends meet on top of my classes. I wouldn't be able to fulfill my dreams as a kid of playing collegiate soccer if it weren't for the athletic and academic scholarship that I was awarded via the sports lottery funds. I cannot tell you how impactful these funds were to my success as a student athlete and the roaring benefits from being on EOU's inaugural men's soccer team. Being on the soccer team enhanced my education, encouraged me to accomplish all of my coursework early, and develop crucial time management skills, all of which were detrimental to my success as an EOU student. I would have never imagined I would have become ASUU president, vice president of Latino Impact on campus, a TRIO student support services tutor, a resident assistant of EOU's off-campus housing, and on top of that, an NAIA scholar athlete all while maintaining a GPA of 3.8 throughout my educational career. Really, really hard stuff. These funds allowed me to really get involved in school and demonstrate my ability to excel and influence others through servant leadership. I am asking you to work towards the 1% restoration of sports lottery funds. Without those funds, EOU students will not have access to post-secondary education. 323 sports lottery scholarship recipients during the 2015-16 academic school year attended EOU, nearly 14% of the recipients around the state. I want to make sure that the future Mountaineers and other student athletes around Oregon get the same opportunity that opened various avenues that helped me stay at EOU. I want to make sure that our 323-plus student-athletes at EOU continue to live their dreams. Higher education is fundamental to my success, and I'm sure it will be to those that enroll in any college in Oregon. I want to make sure generations have that same opportunity, the opportunity to learn, expand, and create lifelong memories along their athletic and academic journey of garnering a degree at EOU and any other Oregon public institution. So, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'll bet your parents are very proud of you.
I do it for them, and I do it for everyone else. So,
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to ask where you went to high school.
I went to Fruitland High School, graduated in 2013 from. Actually, I was thinking of going to College of Idaho, but I was able to attend EOU through academic scholarship and through the athletic scholarship as well. And so I know many students are in that same boat that would choose where I live in Fruitland, so it's right there close to the Oregon-Ontario border there. And so I know a lot of students that are from Idaho that play at EOU, that choose EOU because those funds help them, and it's a lot cheaper compared to College of Idaho or BSU. And so that is very, very, very detrimental to those students in the Valley area.
Senator Roebling.
And you have in-state tuition.
Yes, and that helps a lot. That makes a huge difference, and so it definitely helps as well.
Eastern is quite an institution, and I'm experienced with them because I was on the board of Mount Hood Community College for 10 years, and Eastern has a satellite campus at Mount Hood Community College as well, so we have a close relationship there. It's an integral part of our whole situation in terms of academics, especially for Eastern Oregon and Eastern Oregon students. So,
definitely. The same one in Ontario, the regional center as well. They were able to help me transfer over to EOU as well.
Yeah. Any other questions for our witnesses? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for your time.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, as the transition happens under today's OLIS date, there is a document that has sort of some supplemental information about each of the next number of programs, these state programs that come forward. So if you if they don't describe something in enough detail, there is further information under today's date in OLIS.
Coach S. Smith Warner, Coach M. Monroe, members of the committee, we'd now like to move on to talk about another set of programs which have legislative origin and importance to the state. As a quick reminder, in 2013, the legislature separated the university's education and general fund into two new categories, the Public University Support Fund, which we discussed yesterday, and then the Public University State Programs. These state programs are comprised of institutes, centers, and programs, all of which have legislative origins and serve statewide priorities. There are details of all of these programs in the materials provided to you, and today we will just have time to highlight two of those, the Toolwood Design Institute, Oregon State University and University of Oregon, and then to talk to you about a request from OIT for an Oregon Renewable Energy Center. We do have here a slide which shows the historic allocation of the TV's programs, the legislatively approved budgets. And then in green, we have three different representations of the request. You can see the The GRB, the governor's recommended budget, holds the allocation to those flat at $39.1 million, which is the same as the 2015-17 allocation. The higher education request increased that to 40.9. To do that, it used a current service level calculation, I think about 1.1%, and increased additional funds for support of the Oregon Renewable Center. The university's request is higher than that at $41.9 million. That is a request for both funding for the Oregon Renewable Energy Center and a more appropriate, realistic current service level calculation to reflect the real drivers that universities are seeing in terms of costs. So as I said, we'll be just highlighting two of those programs today, the Tallwood Design Institute, which was originally funded as the Advanced Wood Products, and then we'll move on from that to the Oregon Renewable Energy Center, OREC. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jeff Huntington from Oregon State University and Judith Schein from University of Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. Welcome.
Heavy props.
That's right.
And Mr. Huntington, are you first?
I am. Thank you, Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner. I'm Jeff Huntington. I'm the Director for Strategic Initiatives for the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. And my colleague here.
LD.
Go ahead, Judith.
Good morning. I'm Judith Schein from the University of Oregon, and today we're going to be talking about the National, what you know as the National Center for Advanced Wood Products Manufacturing and Design, that we're now calling the Tallwood Design Institute for obvious reasons. This represents an unusual collaboration between the ducks and the beavers, as you can see.
I love it.
And leverages our national leadership, respectively, in sustainable design, forestry, and engineering. And through the collaboration, we're able to connect the entire chain from research into wood products to manufacturing to design of wood buildings and post-occupancy evaluation, which feeds back into the research loop, all to develop and put more wood products into the marketplace for economic development in Oregon.
The beginning thoughts of putting together this institute, we really focused on how we can grow our timber-dependent community economies through expanding markets for wood products that we're capable of making in Oregon but maybe haven't been in the past, and working to do that by connecting the supply chain all the way from the fiber source and manufacturing of wood products to the design and engineering folks that are putting together buildings and commercial structures that could be using wood in innovative mm-hmm. ways but maybe aren't, and trying to expand those markets so we can improve the demand. And so how we've gone about doing that is to really link together the forestry expertise we have in our university system with the engineering programs that we have, with the architecture programs, and then everything we do is identified as trying to achieve deliverables through the private sector to expand those markets for wood products. One of the things that we have tried to do is organize the work of the Institute so that we really focus on three things: applied research that will support the industry, product development and testing that will get new projects and new uses online and help the building codes catch up with the potential for some of these new products, and then training and education. Right now, at this point, we have about $1.9 million in applied research that is underway in this budget biennium, and that is thanks to the state appropriations, which we have leveraged into federal grant funds, that we then work with stakeholders from the full supply chain again to identify what research would be directly relevant to supporting projects that are anticipated or planned or could be put into place. And this is a long list. I'm not going to go through it, but you can see the scope of some of the research that's happening right now. We also work closely with our wood products manufacturers, and we develop prototypes of them. We test them for the certification so that they have what they need to enter into the marketplace. In front of me is an example of a CLT product. You probably have heard of D.R. Johnson in Riddle, Oregon. They're the first manufacturer certified to make cross-laminated timber for structural applications in the United States. Comes directly from the partnership that the university's created with Valerie Johnson to do some of the initial design and testing and then to go through the certification process hand-in-hand with her. 2 years ago when we started the Institute, this is what we had to talk about. Today, we've got a new product that is going through processing or testing right now, and it's called a mass plywood panel. This is being put in place by Ferris Lumber in Lyons, Oregon, small community east of Salem. If you can imagine, this is similar to CLT. It'll serve the same structural purpose in buildings, but it's made with veneer and plywood instead of a dimensional lumber, which you see on CLT. Ferris, we took the company to Europe and introduced them to some testing labs and some fabrication centers in Europe. They came back and started to think about how they could devise a new product based on what they already make. We began the testing process with them, and they are now going through certification, and they are investing millions of dollars in capital infrastructure to expand their manufacturing facility to begin to go into commercial production of this product probably in January of next year. For a scale, you can look at these two products. You can imagine something that's 24 to 30 inches deep, 12 feet wide, and 60 feet long. That's the scope of these panels that we're talking about for structural application in buildings. So we do a lot of partnering and trying to work in product development.
And because the building codes have not fully incorporated the new mass timber products, it's a little bit of a barrier. We're working with both building code officials and with project engineers and architects, with the designers, to do performance testing to show that the materials actually do meet the intent of the code in order to get more of these projects built in various ways, including in Portland with the Framework Project and with projects around the state. We're also involved in education and training outreach. Some recent initiatives include a roundtable we hosted looking at the relationship between affordable housing and mass timber and looking at the future developments in that area. One project that U of O students have been working on, for example, is with the city of Springfield. We tested the feasibility of mass timber parking garage in a seismic zone, and did enough work on it to convince the city that they, in fact, should go ahead with it as a real project. We're now working with Lane County on the design of a new county courthouse that they hope is going to be a mass timber project.
So to close out here, many of you are familiar with the new Forest Science Complex that is a capital construction project that is going to be the headquarters for the College of Forestry at Oregon State University, and it's an all-wood structure, the new PV Hall. And we actually have been working with the industry so that we're sourcing all of the wood that will be in the structure within 250 miles of Corvallis as a demonstration of the scope and the breadth of different wood products that the Oregon timber industry is capable of making. But up at the top of the screen is a new laboratory that'll be a high bay testing facility with fabrication equipment that the industry can use for testing and development of new products. And that will also be, when it's constructed in 2018, the headquarters for this joint institute between the two universities. The budget slide for us that we wanted just to put in front of you for a minute is really the it reflects the level of funding that keeps the Institute going forward that is in the governor's recommended budget. We've been working closely with our congressional delegation over a number of years and have a pretty steady stream of appropriations that amount to about $3 million biennially between a U.S. Economic Development Agency and a direct congressional appropriation that we get in large part because we have the state funds that we use to match. And it is a one-to-one match for us, and so we really have leveraged the money that we received in the current biennium and what we will receive in the governor's recommended budget if it's appropriated by the legislature this time around. That is partially for operational funds, but we use it for research, testing, and to do some of the educational programs we talked about. The universities have about $1 million of in-kind match in staffing and time and research capacity that we've turned and focused into this effort collectively. And then, of course, we've got a substantial capital construction project with donations from the industry to complete. So we're happy to answer any questions that you may have, and we're happy to visit with any of you on follow-up at any time. And thank you very much.
Thank you. And please.
Oh, excuse me, a couple questions. Fire, you always think about fire when you're building with only wood. How do you deal with the threat of fire? Also, of course, we're worried about the big earthquake that's coming. How do your wood structures, how are they going to handle the big one? And cost, you know, compared to traditional steel and concrete construction, what about the cost of all wood construction?
I'll try to answer those briefly.
Okay.
There's a lot of fire testing going on now, but certainly a lot of it's been done in Europe, but our codes are a little stricter, two-hour ratings rather than 90-minute. And there's fire testing that's going on now, particularly for the framework project and others. Essentially, heavy timber chars in a fire, and it has a char layer that protects the rest of the wood. So as long as the timber members are bigger than 6 inches by 8 inches, they're in fact very safe. You can see heavy timbers that have been in buildings for over 100 years that have lasted a really long time, and they actually do better than concrete and steel because of that characteristic. In terms of what was the second one?
Earthquake.
Seismic, right, resilience. One of the things that we're looking at now is resilience in wood structures. They developed a bunch of new seismic resistance systems in New Zealand in particular after the Christchurch earthquake, where they look at taking big panels of mass timber and using a little bit of steel to post-tension them, which means that you potentially have cables on either side of them. The steel cables allow the walls to rock. You can do the same thing in precast concrete, but the difference is when those rock, they also break. And they will protect health, life, safety. People can get out of the buildings alive, but they can't be rebuilt, unlike the wood panels, which in fact hold up extremely well and can be reused for much faster building. In terms of cost, already where mass timber is used a lot in Europe, mass timber is not only cost competitive with steel and concrete, but in many ways superior because it goes in so quickly, so quietly, and because it weighs so much less, it requires much less in foundations. So there are lots of advantages to them, both, you know, cost, seismically, and in terms of fire. Mm-hmm.
Chair Monroe, as an addition to that, I would say that the framework project mm-hmm. that you may have heard about, that's a tall wood building in Portland, will use this resilient design to the rocking yeah. design for seismic. And the new PV hall on campus that we're building will have this post-tension design so that it'll be the first building on campus that if an earthquake happens, not only protect life and safety, but we hope to be able to move back in and reuse the building without having to tear it down and start yeah. over. And so this is a new innovation that Wood is offering that is becoming is part of what's driving the yeah. interest by the development community.
It's exciting. Yeah. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and part of the other things, and I don't know, you've looked at it engineering-wise, depending on how many windows you have, when it comes to cost of heating, the smaller mass buildings that they've made in Europe that are house-like structures, mm-hmm. They don't need to insulate other than the mass timber.
They still need to do some insulation, actually. The mass timber provides a certain amount of insulation, but it depends on the standards you're working towards. As we move closer and closer to zero, you still need to do some. One of the research projects that one of our UO faculty members is working on now is looking at mass timber in net zero buildings. And in fact, tests have shown that mass timber performs, as you said, better than expected in terms of insulation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Reynolds, who's next?
The next presentations are Josh Barrett, from John yeah. Dumbold, and Christian Diaz, and they'll be talking to you about the Oregon Renewable Energy Center.
Okay.
Good morning, co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warners, and members of the committee. Thanks for having us this morning. My name is Josh Bratt. Professionally, I'm a portfolio management director with Morgan Stanley. In terms of community work and personal background, I serve on the Oregon Talent Council, co-founder of a nonprofit called Power Oregon, and have been a participant in the recent Oregon Renewable Energy Center's strategic task force. For 10 years, I was on the board of directors for the Oregon Environmental Council, and 8 generations of my family have lived in Oregon. I'm coming to you today as a private citizen, as a representative of Power Oregon, and to testify on behalf of the Oregon Renewable Energy Center at the Oregon Institute of Technology, which is the only statutorily designated program in the public university state program. And you saw the slide with the list of those that currently receives no funding as part of that group. My goal today is to convince you to allow the OREC, which I'm going to call the Oregon Renewable Energy Center to save my tongue twisting, to join all 13 of the other statutorily designated programs that have been previously funded by the legislature. As part of our presentation this morning, you're going to hear from the most important constituents of the OREC, and that is students and graduates. When they present their background, I would encourage you to pay particular attention to the reason they chose OIT and OREC over some very stiff competing programs around the country. Before I get to that, I wanted to take just a minute to provide some context, some history, and the sort of background on the accomplishments of the OREC. And the critical role that it plays in Oregon's clean energy and economic future. Most of you are, I'm sure, aware Oregon is a very uniquely positioned in terms of its natural advantages. It's a natural laboratory for clean energy generation. We've got hydro, solar. Thank you. Geothermal, very uniquely positioned in the United States and most would say the world to take advantage of this. We're spending a lot of money as a state. Power Oregon did had the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State do a study in 2014. $800 million of biennium is spent in Oregon on energy policy. So, and if any of you would be interested in seeing that report, be happy to provide it. Talent is a very, very critical component to the successful implementation of those and accomplishing of those policies, and the OREC is a key contributor to that talent pool. If we're going to meet the growing and changing talent needs of employers in the energy space, this program will be absolutely critical to that success. With a lot of changes that are taking place in funding and federal support, the risk of letting it go will not only negatively impact job growth, but and the probability of achieving our clean energy policies, but also squander a huge investment that's been made over the last 16 years. So from a history standpoint, the legislature authorized OREC in 2001 in response to the Oregon Tech's trusted history of advancing renewable energy solutions in Oregon over really 30 years. OREC has a 16-year history of successful execution, producing results with project-based grant funds from federal, state, and private sources. Federal earmarks are no longer available, and state funds are dedicated for other purposes. OREC critically needs consistent funding so the faculty and students have dedicated time to work with emerging companies and grow jobs in Oregon. The work of OREC really basically falls into the three categories that you see on the slide now, and that is energy generation, talent development for the energy industry, and applied research for communities and companies. So what's been accomplished over the What's been accomplished over the last 16 years? ORIC has developed 4 megawatts of renewable energy to power the Klamath Falls campus. It's produced, since 2006, produced 665 graduates for the energy industry. The students have a 97% placement success rate, and I think this is true for OIT in general, so this is typical of the success that they've had from a very practical standpoint, within 6 months. And these are very high and successful and good salaries. About 70% of the graduates stay in Oregon, and the companies that these graduates go to range from the investor-owned utilities to small startups, the energy trust. So it's public, private, quasi. The center provides technical assistance for applied research with 22 different companies currently. Besides the energy generation, ORIC builds talent and applied research skills for the energy industry broadly. The areas of application are renewable energy generation systems, smart grid, energy storage, electric vehicles, energy efficient building designs and devices, energy economics, and policy. On the applied research front, I'm just going to go through the list. They develop prototypes for solar, wind, and other energy devices, test manufacturability of new products, characterize and test batteries, expand storage capabilities, optimize wind, hybrid vehicle control systems, not wind, build and test customized components to reduce production costs, select materials, assess strength of materials, especially composites and metals, utilize geothermal energy to accelerate food and agricultural products, train on the use of Oregon Tech's unique geothermal resource, and invent using renewable energy. The companies that ORIC has worked with include Northwest Renewable Energy Corporation, eWind Solutions, Kerr Avionics, Arcimoto, and many others. So I'm going to defer now before I provide a couple of concluding remarks. Two students who I will let introduce themselves, and a graduate.
Christian.
Welcome.
Coach Esmond Monroe, Smith Warner, members of the committee. My name is Christian Diaz. I am an Army combat veteran and a current graduate student at Oregon Tech. I'm working right now on a project under the auspices of the Oregon Renewable Energy Center with one of our industry partners, Portland General Electric. My project is focused specifically on independent characterization of a novel saltwater battery for possible use in large-scale energy storage projects. These ORIC projects have afforded me two significant opportunities in my education. First, I'm being exposed to novel cutting-edge technologies that I would never get to see in a normal school project. The saltwater battery we're testing now is reportedly safer and more durable than current lithium-ion technology, and hopefully will find use in large-scale projects with PGE. The second opportunity afforded to me is really in being able to develop contacts and, you know, build relationships within the energy industry where I hope to work. Really, I'm getting experience that I'm hoping to be able to leverage with not only the companies that are in the energy industry, but with startups and some of the new up-and-coming technologies. One of the reasons, it was this hands-on kind of industry-driven education that first drew me to Oregon Tech. When I graduated from Portland State University and was looking at graduate programs, it was this grounding in industry-driven education that drew me to Oregon Tech and to ORIC specifically. There's a saying that I used to get yelled at about in the Army, train like you fight. And ORIC provides that for students. It allows us to train in in highly needed skills demanded by our industry partners, and they're the ones who are telling us what to learn. And so we have a leg up as students entering the workforce. Thank you.
Great. Senator Roblin.
Just a quick question, which you may not be able to answer because you're working with PGE. So when it comes to saltwater batteries, are there particular salts that you're experimenting with to find out which allows you to store the power? Or is it just regular salt water?
Coaches Monroe, Senator Smith-Warner, Senator Roblin. The salt water battery we're experimenting with right now is a production model through, I believe it's Aquion battery. I believe it's a sodium ion battery.
Okay.
From what Thank I understand.
You. Is it a South Coast in particular? South Coast salt water?
Well, sodium, we got a lot of sodium, so we do okay with that one. I was just wondering if they're getting to exotic salts that have other kinds of opportunities that may do better, but sodium's a pretty regular
salt.
One.
Yeah, Coos Bay salt.
Must be
yeah.
Coos Bay salt.
No, it's actually, it's Jacobson salt is made from deep water. From our Neatarts Bay, so yes, there are salts on our state, and it is mostly sodium salt. So there you go.
Okay, moving on.
All right, Co-Chair Senator Monroe, Representative Smith Warner, members of the committee. Hello, my name is John Dumbald, and I graduated from Oregon Tech in 2015 with a degree in mechanical engineering. I'm originally from Nevada, and when I was researching colleges to attend, I was drawn to Oregon Tech because of their renowned engineering program, as well as their excellent class sizes and post-grad employment rates. As an engineering student, when capstone projects were presented to us, I gravitated toward a project proposed by a small startup company, Ewan Solutions. The project entailed research, design, and construction of the first prototype ground station and generator for Ewan's airborne wind energy generation system. I was intrigued with the prospect of working with a startup because of the unique challenge proposed, as well as the industry knowledge I would attain through working with them. While the class structure at Oregon Tech helps to teach students the physical constraints to our theoretical knowledge through work in labs, working with a real company on a real problem was the catalyst for me to transition from an educational environment to an industry one. Nearing the completion of the project, and with a growing passion for the project as a whole, I pursued an internship with Ewan, which led to them hiring me full-time. What I valued most from the project was the opportunity to work with a new company on an up-and-coming technology and have an industry partner like Ewan provide project management, materials, and other market-specific resources that I, as a student, cannot otherwise obtain on my own. My project advisor, Don Lee, provided oversight for the students and the project under the advisement of the Board of Renewable Energy Center. But without the release time for faculty to work with industry outreach with potential industry partners, this applied research project would not have been proposed as a student project to my capstone class. And without the ability of OREC to bring in small companies with new ideas and projects for students, I may not have discovered my new passion for airborne wind, the field in which I now work. Thank you for your time today and your consideration and support of the Oregon Renewable Energy Center.
Thank you very much. Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner's members of the committee, just concluding remarks that I would like to make. OREC has thrived since it was established in 2001. Despite the success, it remains the only public university state program, as I mentioned, that is unfunded. The natural question is, why should that change now? And to us, the answer is pretty simple. When the legislature authorized this program in 2001, OIT did not have the strength of the reputation that it currently has. This was a new program, unproven, and hopefully the information that we provided today demonstrates that that there is a very, very solid track record. So I just wanted to make sure that we're emphasize a couple of other points. This program was the first renewable energy engineering degree in the United States, and it's currently ranked number one ahead of some, you know, MIT and Stanford and some other very, very lofty schools. It would be a shame to give up that lead in Oregon. The $975,000 over 2 years would support a director, critical faculty time, and designated projects. At with a great degree of flexibility, whether it's the Wilsonville campus, Klamath Falls. This, to me, this seems like a very small investment to keep a very critical a component of our economic engine going. And it's not only demonstrated success historically, but stands to pay even greater dividends down the road with more clean energy, greater energy efficiency, the talent that employers need right now, and more Oregonians with high-wage jobs. Thank you very much.
Great. Great presentation. Senator Roblin.
Really is a great presentation. And so ORIC is mostly located in Klamath Falls, but it does have outreach to the Wilsonville office. And will it have outreach to the new project we're putting together up in the Portland area around engineering that's up there?
You'll have to talk with Laura McKinney or Lita Collian about that. I'll defer to them on that. I'm confident that it will, but I don't want to overpromise.
Okay. No, I'm really, it is pretty exciting, so thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Back to Mr. Reynolds.
Well, thank you very much. Now, my great pleasure to introduce my counterpart, Oregon State University, Cindy Sagers, and she'll be talking about research at the public universities and the economic impact it has.
Welcome, Sagers.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm joined by a student at OSU, a current student, Brett Lorimore. I'll tell you more about Brett in just a minute. Thank you. The map shown here
You get to put your name on the record, please.
Oh, thank you. I'm Cynthia Sagers. I'm Vice President for Research at Oregon State University. I'm bringing an Oregon State perspective to this presentation, but I must say I represent the 7 public institutions in the state. You can see that the 7 universities, the 7 institutions, have a broad reach across Oregon. This map represents our main campuses, our branch campuses, the OSU Extension Service locations, OSU Research and Extension Centers, Ag Experiment Stations, and the Forest Research Lab. So you see where we do, we find a presence across the state. We're present across the state as what is our impact. We have an important economic impact on the state, and here are just a few reasons why investing in universities and in university research is smart. Research helps students jumpstart their careers by providing effective career preparation, provides hands-on learning experience for students. Students are able to develop collaboration and teamwork skills, develop communication skills, the soft skills we talk about in the STEM fields, enhances student learning through mentoring relationships with faculty, helps students develop critical thinking, creativity, and problem solving and intellectual independence, and finally promotes an innovation-oriented culture. I would say there are 3 statistics I need to mention about smart investments here. We know that students that have a research experience in their undergraduate days are more likely to graduate. They're more likely to graduate in 6 years. They're more likely to move into a field, a discipline with which they've had experience. So research and experiential learning at the undergraduate stage, as you've heard from the other students that have presented, is a really meaningful experience at our universities. Our universities generate a lot of business for the state and in the state. This slide represents for FY16, the externally funded research awards and expenditures. So this is a summation of the research activity for the 7 publics in Oregon. We have an enormous amount of support from the federal government for our research efforts. The state of Oregon is a generous supporter of research in the state. We're growing our commercial and industry contributions as well as nonprofits. In addition, we have other ways of bringing money into the state, that a much smaller portion through personal gifts and support for researchers, as well as licensing revenue. So in total, FY16, our research awards exceed $500 million. This slide represents the virtuous cycle of research and innovation you've heard about. Every single step of the way involves students at our universities, where we begin with a basic research question that drives an intention disclosure, some assessment of market palatability, the development of intellectual property, and then marketing that innovation. Licensing generates revenue, which returns to the university. The product is commercialized, and that generates additional revenue and jobs for the state. This is a virtuous cycle of innovation, and I'm going to explain it by a case study from OSU. Jonathan Hurst, a member of our engineering college, has established a company called Agility Robotics. Agility Robotics is cutting-edge technologies. It brings mobility to robots in ways that has never been seen before on Earth. Agility Robotics began as a really great idea by a smart young OSU faculty member, and it's evolved into two research labs, one in South Corvallis, one in Albany. These folks have a brilliant business plan for moving their robots out into the primary research universities in the United States as test beds. And once those become test beds, the technologies that the universities spin out for those robots become the standard. So they are pushing to be the industry standard for mobile robots on Earth. So we've got a little slide to just kind of tickle you about what Agility Robotics is. That doesn't play. This is Cassie. I sure wish they'd put a head on Cassie so I could have something to look at. But this is the body of the Agility Robotics product. And it is an amazingly agile set of moving legs. This will be the platform that Jonathan Hurst and his company, Agility Robotics, roll out. So let's just go on then. Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Ms. Co-Chair. Vice President Sagers, on the rotation thing, intellectual property right, this has been amazing. I've toured OIT up at Wilsonville and see the things they're doing up there, too. Intellectual property rights, do the students get them? Do the universities get them? And it's something really... If something like the robot, you know, that you're investing, do you have a state a university policy, or is there a public university policy on intellectual property rights for the student, the university, or the company that's providing the grant?
Absolutely. Currently, innovations that roll out of university research belong to the university. As businesses grow out of that university-based research, they become established as their own startups and become independent of the university, create new innovation, that IP would belong to the startup.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. So now let's turn to the real talent at the table. I'd like to introduce Brett Lorimore. Brett's going to tell you a little bit about the value of research to his academic career and to his future. Brett is a computer science major at OSU with a math minor. He'll graduate in June, where he'll join Facebook as a software engineer. Brett?
Welcome.
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, members of the committee. My name is Brett Lorimore. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and like Cindy said, I'm a senior at Oregon State. Today I'd like to tell you about the two opportunities I've had during my time at Oregon State to work on undergraduate research. The first of these was during my junior year when I worked with a master's student on a project where we used convolutional neural networks to analyze NFL game footage. Later on in that year, after I'd completed my work on the project, I was interviewing for a team placement for an internship at Google. During this process, I found that this research experience was of great interest to my interviewers, and I strongly believe that it is this experience that resulted in my being invited to join the team that I did. This team placement turned out to be a really fantastic fit, and I'm actually still working with them today on my senior capstone project. The second project, which I'm currently working on, is focused on graphics processing unit or GPU architecture design. Specifically on this project, we're working on accelerating GPU performance for certain artificial intelligence tasks, like image recognition. This project grew out of a project I completed in one of my courses earlier this year. In my time working on this project, I've had the opportunity to work directly with one of my professors. This has been a really valuable mentoring experience for me and has given me new insight into the academic research process. This relationship has already resulted in my professor writing me an excellent letter of recommendation for my postgrad job hunt, which, as Cindy mentioned, ended in me landing a job at Facebook, which I'll begin this summer. So despite the fact that I do not plan to go to graduate school at this time, my undergraduate research experiences at Oregon State have been some of my most valuable while completing my degree. They've given me exposure to topics and experiences that are not available inside the classroom, and they've augmented my education in a way that differentiates me and ultimately provided the foundation I needed to secure a good job following graduation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can see why I'm so proud to be the Vice President of Research.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here. I just wanted to ask you as well, where'd you go to high school?
I went to Riverdale High School in Portland.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Larimore, I think the pathway to great jobs in the future is using internships. Did the university help you research the internship, and did Google give you some living money or a stipend or whatever?
Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett. My first internship was at Garmin here in Salem, and I got that through a relationship that was started from my receiving a scholarship from Oregon State. My internship at Google actually I pursued on my own, but the reason I got it, I think, was because I had that previous internship experience. And yes, they did provide a stipend because I moved down to the Bay Area for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Coach.
Yeah, we all have to eat. Thank you very much. Nice presentation.
Thank you so much. So we'll now turn it over to another set of programs of importance across the state, the statewide public services.
Okay. This will be our last panel for the day. Come on up.
Good morning. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe, Committee. My name is Dan Arp. I have the pleasure of serving as the Dean of the College of Ag Sciences at Oregon State University and as the Director of the Oregon Agricultural Experiment Station.
And I'm Scott Reed. I serve as Director of the OSU Extension Service.
And I'm Jeff Huntington, for the record, the Director of Strategic Initiatives. On this panel, I'm here filling in for Dean Manis, who's a little bit under the weather today and couldn't be here.
Okay.
And we're here to talk with you about the statewide public services programs. These are three programs that get pulled. Oops. And how do I go backwards now? Get lumped. Previous.
You can do it this way.
There you go. Yeah, just move me back there too.
If it's not going to do it. Not going to do it. Sorry.
Previous. And go back one more on that one. Okay, sorry. So three programs that come together, and we're missing a slide. There we go. The OSU Extension Service, Ag Experiment Station, and the Forest Research Lab. And these three get bundled together in what we call the statewide public services programs. These all have their origin in the Morrill Act in 1862, which created the land-grant universities. So these are all outgrowths of the land-grant university. Oregon State University, of course, is your land-grant university in the state of Oregon. That was formed in 1862. About a quarter century later was the recognition that we had the people's universities, but we also needed support for research, and this recognition came from the federal government, and that created the Ag Experiment Stations. About another quarter century later was the recognition that if we have this research, we need to get it out to the people, to the end users, to the growers, to the farmers, and that created the OSU Extension Service. And then it was about another quarter century later when it was recognized that we also need similar support for research in the forest industry, and that created the Forest Research Laboratory. So all three of these have their origins in federal legislation, which then calls for state matching funds in order to create the funding, to produce the funding that we have for the work that we do. So you've seen a version of this slide in the previous presentation. This one actually looks at the statewide public services programs, and what you see is that we really are your statewide campus. So we have offices across the state. We have extension offices across the state. We have branch experiment stations. We have forest research laboratories. And this is what allows us to get that information, the research that's done from the campus to those branch experiment stations and to those extension offices. But it's very important to recognize that arrow goes the other way as well, in that that we learn from the growers about the challenges that they have in their operations. And that information goes to the extension, and that information gets back to the specialists on campus who can then deal with those problems. So this is very much a two-way road in terms of the information flow. Next slide. Points out then that the dollars that come to us, we leverage very heavily. So you heard in the previous presentation about the importance of the leveraging the dollars that we get. So the state dollars that we get roughly get leveraged by about a factor of two as we use those dollars to go out and get additional dollars. Most of those dollars come from the federal government. So these are dollars that come from Washington back to the state of Oregon, primarily in the form of federal grants, also in the form of matching capacity dollars, so those legislative dollars that started this whole process, but also dollars from the counties and philanthropic dollars, so private donations that come in. All of these dollars get leveraged, and so about $2 additional dollars for every state dollar that comes in. So there's that big economic footprint to begin with. But that's before we actually do any work with the dollars. So those dollars now get put to work in research and in training and in educational programs across the state. And the economic footprint of those dollars, economic studies have shown over and over again that it's in the neighborhood of about a tenfold economic impact. For every dollar that gets invested, every state dollar, you get about a tenfold economic return. With those dollars. An easy example to think about is research that we would do into producing a new wheat variety. So that's work that we're carrying out at Oregon State University on an ongoing basis. That new wheat variety gets adopted, leads to increased yields, leads to decreased use of pesticides because it carries with it a resistance package in that wheat variety. And so now we have increased yields, increased dollars, which impact those growers in Northeast Oregon and also in the valley. But it doesn't stop there, of course, because now those increased yields work their way out the Port of Portland, where that creates increased opportunities for the people working there and living in the Portland area as well. So tremendous economic benefits from the dollars that are invested in the statewides. Economic benefits, but as I mentioned, also environmental benefits as well. A little bit more difficult to put a dollar amount on, but there are tremendous opportunities there as well. I'll turn it over to my colleague, Scott Reed.
Largely through the Extension Service, both community and human capacity is levered across the state as well. It's done through more than 13,000 trained volunteers who help us to.
And Mr. Reed, you get to put your name on the record too.
Okay, I thought we introduced earlier. I'm Scott Reed. I serve as director of the Oregon State University Extension Service. Yep. These trained volunteers, you know, also live and work in communities and provide peer-to-peer education to those who are the recipients of extension programs. You know them as master gardeners, master woodland managers, master recyclers, and other trained volunteer programs, as well as adult leaders of our statewide 4-H youth development program. Collectively, last year we reached more than half of the state's population with a direct educational experience through the Extension Service. 2 years ago, you invested in expanding the work of the statewide public services by providing an additional $14 million that allowed us to address key issues, you know, across the state, both in urban and rural settings. And this slide illustrates the nature of the new hires that we were able to make. On average, I think we were able to put about one additional person on the faculty and staff per county, you know, across the state. What's at risk for the upcoming biennium is about 70% of the additional investment you made 2 years ago. And in order to maintain the program investments that we've made requires the continuing service level roll-up of $9.4 million. And now, importantly, with strong stakeholder support, Senate Bill 805 was unanimously approved by the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee and passed to the full Ways and Means Committee. Jeff?
Hit the buttons if you don't mind. For the record, Jeff Huntington from the Oregon State University College of Forestry. I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes talking about the issues and how we kind of have aggregated up some of the areas of concern that we've targeted funds to do the investment that will have the economic return. And you can see on the slide we talk about things in the context of sustainable management of working landscapes and how to integrate the rural community jobs that are dependent on maintaining healthy working landscapes in the context of whatever the area is of the state where that is at issue. Water quality and quantity were areas that we've made substantial investment in across the programs. Of course, you've heard a little bit about value-added manufacturing today from me already, but that happens across agriculture and forestry sectors. Public health, food safety, and security is one that when I first became exposed to the statewide public service programs, I hadn't really thought about a lot, but it is a significant investment and of great impact in parts of the state based on the work that the Extension Service is doing. And then, of course, some of the education components of the program. Go ahead. Just three quick examples that honeybees. Honeybees is an area that has some significant impacts and concerns across our state, and it's an area that there's a lot of stakeholder interest in having the statewides really engage in and be active in. And you can kind of look at the economic impact of the honeybee issue in Oregon. Sage grouse is one that many folks in this room are familiar with, and I won't spend time on it, but that's one where the active on the ground, boots on the ground, behind a pickup truck, working with ranchers to kind of cope and address the sage grouse issue has been a substantial effort of the Oregon State University statewides. And then I'm going to pause for just a moment and spend a little more time on marbled murrelet. And when we did the roll-up and the increase of statewide public service programs last biennium, College of Forestry took a slightly different approach to the investment, and we used the additional funds to invest heavily in our research engine at the college and to really work with stakeholders to focus in on an initiative that would have that would be of greatest interest to working forest landscapes. And universally, the marbled murrelet issue that the coastal area is facing was something that was identified by our constituents as really needing a long-term focused research initiative that was designed not just to provide credible science on how active timberland management would relate to conservation of species, but also be very relevant and very timely in the data that it provides so that it would be useful to land managers, both state lands and private forest land management. So we have invested heavily in that as an initial research initiative, and it's a complicated process with a little bird that you have to capture out at sea at night and tag it and track it into the old growth stands to see where it nests. It's the size of a robin. It flies 75 miles an hour. I was going to bring in another prop for you, but I decided I didn't want to be met by federal agents outside the room. But it is a tricky task. But it's the kind of research that is so meaningful to an industry that has substantial economic influence and impact in the state economy. And it's one that isn't done because you bump into it. You have to go into it thoughtfully and with long-term investment. And it's this kind of work that we're able to do through the statewide public service programs, whether it's agriculture or forestry or with extension behind a pickup truck, that really drives home the relationship of the university to what's going on in the ground and in our rural economies in particular. I will just pause for a minute because Dean Manis isn't here to share some news we received this week. The Center for World University Rankings released their 2017 rankings of universities worldwide. And I'm going to brag just for a minute. Oregon State University College of Forestry was ranked number 2 in the world, and number 1 in the United States. And it's a great big moment for us. We're really thrilled. We were number 4 in the world in the last rankings. But the reason I bring it up today, besides just bragging because the dean would have me if I didn't do it publicly, but the reason I bring it up is because we fold these funds into the research engine that we have, and it's integrated across all of the programs, whether it's agriculture or forestry again. And so it's hard to tease that out, but it does make a real difference in the capacity of our faculty to really, and our employees to really engage in what counts. So thank you for very much for your time, and that's the end of our presentation.
Senator Roblin.
So is Yale number 2?
No.
Oh, they went down a ways. That's really good. I have a Yale niece that I've got to talk to. She used to always bring up forestry in Yale. So.
Additional questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Rogers. Mr. Reynolds. Mr. Reynolds for the final comment.
Brief.
Chair Smith Warner. Chair Monroe, members of the committee, I want to thank you really for your attention over the last 2 days. We've had an opportunity just to touch a little bit upon the teaching and the research of a public service of the public universities. It's this work that goes on between staff, faculty, and students, and all of it has a huge economic impact across the state. And I do thank you for your opportunity and for listening for the last 2 days. 2015-17, we were incredibly grateful for your support through the allocation to the universities. And you can see here the request that we've talked about for the next biennium, an increase in the Public University Support Fund. And we would like to keep the funding we have for the sports lottery and continue to do the work in terms of the state programs and the state and the statewide public services programs. We hope that 15-17 is the beginning of a movement forward for all of the work that the universities do, and that we won't be looking back on the last biennium as a high point, but really as a turning point. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson, anything for the final, and what's up on Monday?
Monday is public testimony for public universities, so I plan to have it in this room at this point with an overflow next door. We'll see if room F is available and use that if necessary.
Okay. Anything? See you all on Monday and we're adjourned. See you all on Monday and we're adjourned.